welcome to the program. This is Debbie Troy. This week I am guest hosting on New Books in Politics. Our guest today is Andrew Breitbart, the author of Righteous Indignation, Excuse Me While I Save the World. Andrew is an internet provocateur, the owner of a number of websites that aim to take down what he calls the Democrat media complex. Andrew had a somewhat conventional upbringing in California, very much a product of the media, but also had what he calls a series of epiphanies that have transformed him from what he calls a go-along, get-along liberal to a very provocative and engaging conservative who is looking for ways to change the way the media influences the political debate in this country. So without any further comment, we will lead into the interview with Andrew Breitbart, the author of Righteous Indignation. Hello, we have Andrew Breitbart on the phone. Andrew, how's it going?
I'm doing very well, Tabby.
Thank you for joining us today on the New Books in Public Policy podcast. We're thrilled to have you. You have this new book out. It's called Righteous Indignation. And the way you can tell that a book is selling well is when you see it in an airport bookstore. And I saw this in the bookstore in Indianapolis yesterday. So congratulations to you on that.
Thank you. Well, I do the Greg Garrison show in Indianapolis every week, and he's been very helpful. He understands what it is that I'm trying to do out there. Not everybody does.
Well, that sounds like a perfect segue into the conversation. I'd love to know what it is you're trying to do, and also who you are and how you got your start.
Wow, that's what the book is about, Righteous Indignation. It is about who I am and how I got my start. And I'm not your typical right winger. I started off life as a default liberal, and I spent much of my life through my early 20s having gone to prep school, having gone to Tulane University with an American Studies degree, thinking that I was inherently virtuous on the basis of my default liberalism. And then when I graduated into the real world, I started to have some very awkward feelings that started to challenge the liberal orthodoxy that I had been handed, not just in the theoretical academic world, but the reinforcements that I got from Hollywood and popular culture and mainstream media. And a series of epiphanies, which are described in great detail in Righteous Indignation, I started to challenge the matrix, which I call the Democrat media complex in the book. And that is the natural alliance of the Democratic Party, liberal interest groups, and the mainstream media to define the American narrative. And that American narrative very much creates some simple defaults. If you're for the children, liberal. If you're against the children, you're a conservative. If you're for the environment, you're a liberal. And if you're against the environment, you're a conservative. If you're anti-war, you're liberal. That means you must be pro-war, and you must be for pillaging and raping as well. And I had a very simple worldview that by simply at a cocktail party stating that I was anti-war, that I was pro-children and pro-environment, it caused me social, it gained me social benefits. But when I entered into the real world and had to get a real job and self-esteem and survival was born upon the ability to find an employer that was willing to pay me, which meant that I had to provide something in return, my sense of entitlement hit a wall. And I had to start providing my wares, my work, my time for somebody, and I started to get paid, and I started to gain a self-esteem that had been deprived of me within the artificial world of academia that said if you are liberal, you have self-esteem because you're an inherently good person. So those were the first seeds of doubt that were planted in me, and then I started to see that the mainstream media was rigged, and Hollywood was rigged, and academia was rigged in order to create this false narrative. I decided to fight back, and it's been about a 16-year journey in the new media, where I've developed some tools, created some websites, worked on some important websites in the new media that have allowed for me not just as an individual without a newspaper or a major network or a radio station, I've been able to create some tools and hand off some tools to the average citizen that now realizes that if you don't like the Democrat media complex and you don't think that they're telling the truth, I'm handing people tools so that they can start to fight back.
Yeah, you know, I would add one slight amendment to your kind of rules at the beginning about it. If you're for the children, you're a liberal. I say if you're for the children, you're considered liberal. But if you have lots of children, you're conservative.
Yeah, no, there are any points of entry when it comes to the left, I'm pointing out the hypocrisy of their point of view. I mean, I'm for the environment. Well, apply that to any of the celebrities or the politicians that want to give those people who have actual children more than 1.2 children, which would be the liberal policy if they can create a 1.3 point child liberal rule, is that we who have more than 1.3 children, such as me, I have 4 children, we're being told by Sheryl Crow, Ariana Huffington, and Lori David and the rest of the celebrity class that we shouldn't have an SUV when these very people fly between their coastal liberal enclaves where they have large houses in private planes. So hypocrisy is the beginning point of taking on the Democrat media complex.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned Ariana Huffington and then in there, because you got your start in many ways with her. I mean, your first the first time that you were noticed by the wider media was when you helped create the Huffington Post with Ariana Huffington. What was that like, and what are your relations with her like now?
Oh my goodness, my relations. You want to go there? I started off in a very interesting position with Ariana Huffington, where I was her lowly researcher back in 1997. Matt Drudge introduced me to her, and she gave me my first LexisNexis account. So I'll be eternally grateful for her giving me this. And I'm an information addict, and she gave me my, you know, my greatest direct connection to the mother lode, which is LexisNexis. She was a conservative back then, and so the first thing that we did when I worked with her was to disinter the Clintons' number one donor, Larry Lawrence, from Arlington National Cemetery, because he had falsified that he had been a merchant marine victim of a German bombing attack on a ship called the Horace Bushnell. It was a complete made-up lie, and President Clinton created a waiver for him to be the first non-military member to be in Arlington based upon the false claim that he was a merchant marine. So the first thing that I did with Ariana was get a guy dug up from Arlington National Cemetery. So she gave me my first taste of what it was like to enter the media fray, to go after your political opponents and to expose things that the mainstream media wouldn't report. Not only did Ariana have the final say in that, because he was disinterred, I learned everything I needed to know about the Democrat media complex by their reflexive attacks on her, where they attacked Ariana Huffington, claiming that this was the lowest that they had ever seen a Republican go, falsely claiming that a guy wasn't a war hero, when it was in fact proved true everything that she was reporting. The mainstream media went scurrying for the hills. Nobody apologized. I remember Maureen Dowd said that what she did was beneath contempt. Maureen Dowd never apologized. CNN never apologized. Being on the left, being in the Democrat media complex, means you never have to say you're sorry. So a lot of the tactics that I use with my new media is accepting the premise. It's the most important thing that a person getting into new media has to understand. The mainstream media is the Democratic Party. It is the communications arm of the Democratic Party. So if you have a potent story of corruption like Acorn, like James O'Keefe and Hannah Giles did, when they came to me, I told them, your peril is an acorn. They're weak cheese. Your peril is going to be the mainstream media, because they're going to defend them. No matter how much truth, no matter how much awful video you portray, showing that every office except for one and about 10 offices, Acorn's willing to help aid and abet a pimp and a prostitute trying to set up an underage illegal alien sex slave operation using government cash. Instead of Acorn being under scrutiny by the mainstream media, by the Democrat media complex, I told them, I predicted, as it came true, that James Hanna and I would be the objects of the Democrat media complex's ire and perpetuity for exposing an organization that they have protected for years because it serves their liberal interests.
You know, it's interesting in the section in the book where you talk about this, I guess you're asked at what point, I guess by James, are we going to take down Acorn? And you think, no, we're going to take down the media, which is an interesting response. Also, I also found that interesting that in that whole opening section, when you talk about we want to take down the media, you are so much a media product. I mean, all the TV you watched and the movies and the music, I mean, that kind of made you who you are. But you're also very hostile to it because you see there's an ideological agenda at work that it kind of is tied together in a way that maybe you don't realize when you're watching, I don't know, Gilligan's Island and listening to Green Day.
Yeah, no, I definitely was a product of it, and it benefited me. I was a go-along to get along guy, but I think that something profound happened to me. Seeds of doubt were planted in me when I went from my morally superior state even around Hollywood executives' children and Hollywood executives and stars and media dwellers and the people who were shaping the national dialogue. When I went to New Orleans and I went to the Monroe Dormitory at Tulane University, and I met people from St. Louis, St. Paul, from Connecticut, and Fort Petersburg, Florida, you name it, people from all around the country started coming into my dorm, and I had this morally superior sensibility that I'm from California, I'm super cool, I'm super hip, I must know more than these people. And each individual and their friends and their families offered me a strange perspective into how distorted my worldview was. And that contradiction of what I thought of Middle America, the people from Middle America, and how they live their lives, and the reality was a massive divide that ultimately would have consequences when I graduated. Because when I went back to Los Angeles and I started hearing at cocktail parties and at dinner parties that were inhabited by the elite in Hollywood, where they would talk about flyover country and talk about how stupid people were, and they would talk about a political mindset that almost treated these people like, we are so smart and we are so superior, we need to create a political class, we need to create a political environment where we're controlling them because they can't change their own undergarments. And I remember having conversations with these people that weren't yet based upon my belief that I was a conservative or Republican, because I didn't even know what that was, but I remember defending their valor and their righteousness. I said, I know these people. Do you? You went to school at NYU. You went to school at Harvard. You went to school at Stanford. What was your interaction with Middle America? Because mine has only been positive. And I don't think that people in Hollywood are in much of a position to lecture Middle Americans on how they lead their lives. I mean, you turn over every stone in Hollywood and you're not going to find that many people who aren't addicted to either drugs or their own self-worth based upon the fact that they're an extra in a sitcom. The narcissism and the hideous behavior in this town is too much to bear, especially in the context of these people lecturing Middle Americans on what they should think and how they should behave.
You know, that's an interesting point about Hollywood. You turn over everybody and then there's a dysfunctionality to the lives there. And even just today we read in the newspaper about the one Hollywood marriage that we thought was maybe a real one, the Arnold Schwarzenegger marriage, is they're headed for divorce also. And I know in your book you have a little story, I guess you played tennis with Arnold Schwarzenegger and he tried to kill you or something. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I voted for Arnold Schwarzenegger, so there's a tad bit of hypocrisy in this story, but it was between him, a porn star, Ariana Huffington, and the late Gary Coleman, in the great Davis recall election, I believe of 2004, I believe it was, maybe 2003. I said I grew up quasi a child of privilege, right? My parents were middle class. My dad ran a restaurant. My mom was a bank executive. They lived on the cusp of middle class and upper middle class lifestyle in a very upper middle class part of West Los Angeles called Brentwood. And I just remember going to private school with the right people. And my parents took me out to Malibu Racquet Club at the height of the late 70s, Bjorn Borg, Jimmy Connors, tennis era. And my tennis instructor was the tennis instructor to the Stars, coincidentally, a guy by the name of Steve Morris. And I remember one day, Farrah Fawcett, I had a Farrah Fawcett iron-on t-shirt back then, at the height of Charlie's Angels thing, tapped me on the shoulder and said, "You know where Steve is?" Steve Morris, the instructor. I said, "Oh, yeah, absolutely." And I took her on a wild goose chase for about 20 minutes just to be with her. So Arnold Schwarzenegger was another person before he was as famous as he was, but I think that this was kind of Conan the Barbarian phase. He would take lessons after my lesson or before my lesson. And I remember, well, Arnold Schwarzenegger, when I would come up there and I would help clean up the tennis balls, you know, like after a lesson, there are about 200 tennis balls, you know, that you pick up with this thing called the lobster. And I just remember Steve and Arnold used to go to the service line and try and hit me and my friend Larry Soloff, who happens to be my business partner now. So he and I are willing to testify under oath and to take lie detectors on this. And he and Steve would do everything they could to take these 10-year-olds and serve the ball and make it so that we were stuck in a corner somewhere, cowering, and then they would have a field day just pouncing us with these 100-mile-an-hour serves where the two of us would have to cry uncle, usually where we were laughing and crying at the same time because we were in so much pain. And I have to be honest with you, when people talk about Arnold Schwarzenegger as being sadistic, I experienced it. It was all done in quasi good fun, but in hindsight, it doesn't seem like the type of thing that I would do with a 10-year-old stranger.
No, I would hope not. I know you'd be willing to testify in it, but I would suspect that the statute of limitations is up on that one.
Yeah.
You talk about the...
I forgive him, especially considering he's going through personal troubles right now.
Yeah, that's clear, and kind of you to forgive him. You talk a little bit about the contrast between a Hollywood childhood and a Midwestern childhood, but in any ways, you kind of had a pretty conventional childhood yourself. You had that interesting line at the beginning of the book. You said that the night that the first sushi restaurant opened in California, your family had meatloaf. Do you think that helped give you this sort of differentiation from the kind of dysfunctional LA scene?
That my parents planted the seeds of conservatism in me, and that the natural tendency when you're 14 and 15 years old to trail away from your parents' tutelage. I mean, who wants to go out with their parents on a Friday and a Saturday night when they're 14 and 15 years old? You start wanting to hang out with the cool kids. You start dating. You start wanting to say the right things, do the right things. You start, your relationship becomes something, if not strained with your parents, it becomes of alienation. And my parents were silent generation types, where most of my friends' parents were baby boomers going to the right concerts. I just remember my friend Jeff, I love his dad to this day, but Jeff's dad one night was taking a limo from the Bryan Ferry concert to go to the Rod Stewart concert in one night, and it was the same night that my mother was watching the Lawrence Welk show on television, and it was just such a bizarre juxtaposition. And so in hindsight, I realized that my parents were silent generation conservatives who believed in conservative ideals, behaved that way, spent their money that way, they saved their money, they didn't spend it conspicuously, and eventually I had to come around to the, almost embarrassed you know, when I was 23, 24, 25 years of age, coming to my parents and having to apologize to them for having strayed. And, you know, they really didn't even take offense to my off years. I think that was their whole point, was kind of like, I think the Amish with Rumspringa. Hey, if you want to go test your oats for, you know, sow your oats for a few years, that's fine. And I'm glad that they gave me, you know, my conservative underpinnings for me to discover, you know, the juxtaposition.
Yeah, it sounds like you not only had conservative-minded parents, but you also have a conservative-minded father-in-law as well. And I guess he introduced you to Rush Limbaugh initially?
Well, I got very lucky in that regard, because as I was starting to have those awkward tinges of conservative doubt of my liberal background, I was waiting tables in the uber liberal section of Los Angeles, RC Venice. And one of the celebrities that I, you know, I remember waiting tables on, you know, people like, you know, Julia Roberts, but one of the regulars there was Orson Bean. And I remember watching Orson Bean, you know, on the weekends come over there with the New York Times crossword puzzle. And I thought, boy, Orson Bean was always the most sophisticated guy out there. He was a raconteur on The Tonight Show, to tell the truth. And I knew who he was, but he was almost like Christopher Hitchens. You know, almost, how do you even hold a conversation with a guy that's that smart? Well, I start coincidentally starting to date his daughter, who I eventually married and have four children with. And during the period of time that I started to date her, I started going over to his house for dinner and to hang out. And I remember seeing that he had Rush Limbaugh's book on his shelf, and I remember having a conversation with him where my assumptions of Rush Limbaugh's guilt were emblazoned in my brain. And I remember saying, oh, why do you have this book here? For ironic purposes? He says, no, I like Rush Limbaugh a lot. I said, are you kidding me? He's a racist, a Nazi. You know, I have all those reflexive, you know, talking points in my brain. And I look back on it, and I swear, and this maybe is instructive for you or others, when you hear a lefty say that, and you ask, have you ever listened to the show? They say, of course. They always say, of course. They haven't, because I believed it. I would have passed the lie detector test at that point. When Orson said, have you ever listened to the show? And I said, yes, of course I have. But I hadn't. I had just been told so many times by so many people in the popular, you know, culture that he was a racist in this, that I just took the word for it. And as I started to recognize that there was an inequity in the mainstream media, that you're being indoctrinated, not given a series of different ideas so that you can make up your own, when I started to realize this, there was no better guy, there was no better Yoda for me than Orson Bean, because he went from being a blacklisted communist in the late 1950s who had Ed Sullivan himself calling him up with regret, saying you were in the Red Channels newspaper, and, you know, stating that you were on the left, you know, communist side of things. I can't withstand the heat to put you on the TV. And so for Orson to have come from the far left to being a right winger, living on the Venice Canal opposite George Carlin, and he was living the same bohemian life that I aspired to live, but he happened to have conservative values. My doubts on God, which, you know, I'm agnostic in the book, I keep having enough things happen in my life where it's almost impossible to doubt the existence of God, because I don't think that I would have been able to make the not just the traveling aspect from left to right, but my self-confidence, my use of humor as a mechanism to convey my ideas, of comfort in my own skin would not have happened had I not had Orson as my Yoda.
It sounds like both of you are sort of a proto-neoconservative in a way. But the Rush thing and the Orson thing, they sound like part of a series of epiphanies that you had. And I know the next and perhaps most important epiphany you had was when you first heard about this internet thing and particularly of Matt Drudge. Can you talk about how influential that was in shaping your path and your worldview?
Well, I mean, I would say that from 1992 to 1996 was the bridge. from doubting my default liberalism to becoming a conservative. And Orson was there guiding me over that bridge. But around 1995, at a moment of time where I needed this, I happened to meet Matt Drudge, and I happened to get on the internet, not AOL, not CompuServe, not Prodigy, all services that I had had since the early days of, you know, the modem and, you know, that type of communication. But the real Audubon that was the internet. Around 1995, I met Drudge, and he came over to Orson's house when we were house-sitting while Orson was out of the country. And I met Matt Drudge, and because I started to read his newsletter, the Drudge Report, very early on, and it was such a fascinating mix of politics and insider entertainment industry information that nobody else was reporting, and a strange mix of earth sciences, earthquakes and tornadoes and stuff like that. Just such a unique mix of the news, an interesting mix of the news, that I reached out, found out he lived in Los Angeles. He comes down to the Venice Canals, and I talked to him for 4 hours when he's not on his job at the time as a manager of the CBS gift shop where he folded, you know, designing women t-shirts.
Miracle. I didn't know it yet. That was his first job.
Yeah, and I remember thinking that this guy was definitely not of my West Side Los Angeles ilk of Harvard, Stanford, working for, you know, working in the executive suites as a lawyer or a creative executive in Hollywood. This guy was kind of in the bowels of the industry folding t-shirts. And I listened to him talk about the media and to talk about politics in this nascent internet environment. And as he putted away in his Hyundai in the Venice Canal alleyway, as he drove away, I looked at my wife and I said, that guy is a visionary. He's going to change the world.
Yeah, and in many ways he has. You later talk in the book about your time as an American Studies major at Tulane. I'm an American Studies PhD from University of Texas, and something you said really struck me about how when you do American Studies, you read a lot more Adorno and Gramsci than you do Twain or Lincoln or Jefferson, and I found that to be the truth when I was doing American Studies, and it really kind of irked me. I mean, I thought I was doing this degree to learn about the classics of what makes American civilization great, and what really we were learning about was the Frankfurt School and European critics of America. Can you talk about how that helped shape you?
So you agree with me? Like, so you're saying, because that to me was like the one controversial aspect of the book, because I'm rebelling against a professor that, and I was lured under false pretenses into an American studies course. You would think that it would be rah-rah on the Constitution and rah-rah on the, you know, on supporting the underpinnings of what it is to be an American. And it seemed to me, especially in hindsight, when I graduated and I felt that my degree was anything but helpful in terms of giving me the tools and the mindset to enter the real workforce. At the end of the day, they're teaching you that the American middle class, the bourgeois experience, is an inferior manufactured one that is being done to oppress the working class to the expense of an elite, you know, governing, you know, ruling class. And it's hard to get an entry-level job after, you know, 4 years of hearing this type of oppressive jargon, that somehow the person that you want a job from is somehow out to exploit you. And I thank God for alcohol, because I don't think that had I not been in New Orleans doing in Rome what people are supposed to do in Rome, doing in New Orleans what people are supposed to do, and that's drink a lot, I don't think that I would have been savable had I completely imbibed the American Studies Frankfurt School drug, because it's a very sexy, it's a sexy place to go. It's a sexy place. It grants you victimology. It grants you a place at the cocktail party set on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, in Hollywood, and in the academia set to run around with this grand philosophical worldview that somehow the people in flyover country are dupes, and that there's only a specific ruling class of people that are smart enough to see through the matrix. And it just pissed me off that my parents wasted an education that at the end of the day turned me into a glorified Kurt Cobain, a nihilist with a chip on my shoulder against my fellow countrymen.
Yeah, I think favorite, or perhaps least favorite, notion from the Frankfurt School was by Herbert Marcuse, who had this notion of repressive tolerance, that Americans aren't really free.
That's political correctness in a nutshell. Repressive tolerance is, that's why conservatives are always called intolerant. And people say, but I don't understand. I'm tolerant of other worldviews. I may disagree with that person, but I'm tolerant. If you are against the progressive order, you know, of moving towards the progressive point of view, then that means that you're intolerant.
Yeah. The whole notion of American studies is probably worth it. It's own separate podcast.
Well, I'm glad you agreed, because, I mean, I find it ironic, because I wanted to go along to get along, and during my period of time there, I just wrote the bare minimum, and I knew what I had to write. I knew what I had to say in order to graduate by the skin of my chinny chin chin, but I remember feeling dejected. I remember reading these books. I remember reading this weird jargon. I remember thinking there's something wrong here. And if I can start the conversation to get people talking about what has happened to the humanities departments in the name of cultural Marxism, which is what the Frankfurt School is about, then I'll be very happy.
Yeah, well, I mean, my approach was recognizing how open American studies was, meaning it had no real structure, finding places within that lack of structure to take courses that actually interested me and allowed me to graduate. You had a really interesting section on Bill Maher's show, how you kind of went in very prepared and kind of threw him for a loop. And I think the end of that story, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about it, where Sarah Silverman kind of snubs you as you're walking off the set, but Dwight Schultz from the A-Team praises you and thinks you're great. It sounded it was very typical. The A-list celebrities have to think one way, whereas D-list celebrities are freer to think what they want. Do you find that to be an appropriate distinction?
I would reject the classification of Dwight Schultz as a D-list celebrity. I resent, and this isn't about you. He lives in the normal world now. Is that it's very difficult, you know, for you to say, you know what, I'm no longer going to be in the world of celebrity. I see, you know, Paul or Peter Weller has gotten a PhD. Rick Moranis decided to leave Hollywood to raise his children. And there's this weird gradation in class orientation that people have that really, you know, if you're a celebrity and you decide to get off the carousel, you're no longer cool somehow. Well, Sarah Silverman is super, the queen of cool. She serves up her anti-politically correct comedy. She knows that because she's a woman and she's a pro-Obama supporter, that it provides her inoculation from doing the very jokes that a Sam Kinison or Andrew Dice Clay or any other Caucasian, you know, comedian would get attacked for. Anyway, I was on the show, and I decided to stand up for what I believed in, because the last time I had been on the show, a friend said, yeah, you got a few laughs, but why did you stand up for what you believed in? And I realized that I was trying to go along to get along. Went on the show that next time with a singular intent, living down my shame, where I realized that my critic, my friend, understood that I was trying to be liked by the people in the audience and by Bill Maher and his and the people backstage. And I got into war, basically, with the audience. I got into war with Maher, and I got into war with sociology professor and Frankfurt School acolyte, Professor Michael Eric Dyson, where, in essence, the subtext of the entire 30 minutes of anti-comedy was that Rush Limbaugh and I and the Tea Party were all racist, and I just fought it for a half hour. And as I left the stage, it was awkward. The place had been fumigated for comedy. It was just one half hour of awkward television as I was walking off the stage to what was a funeral parlor in my dressing room. As I walked by Sarah Silverman, whose dark humor I mostly appreciate, she walked by Dyson, who spoke in an incomprehensible, iambic pentameter, that only Noam Chomsky could decipher. And as she walked by, she said, "Oh, you did so great." And then she looked at me like I was the devil, walked to my seat with the camera on it, wiped her hand on the sleeve, looked to the audience and to the camera, and said, "Slimy," alluding to me. And it was a strange experience because I did go back to the funeral parlor, saw my family and friends, and they were mortified that I was so, publicly humiliated by everyone that could possibly rejected me in front of millions of people. And as they were trying to assuage my concerns and my feelings, I looked at them and said, "You have no idea. You could not be more wrong. The thing that I feared the most, this very rejection, was like an injection of confidence, self-confidence, and energy that I'd been waiting for. The thing that I was most fearful of was the thing that I needed the most to break through." And that's what much of the book is about, is trying to teach people that these Alinsky tools of trying to demoralize you and make you feel like you're the anomaly, that you're crazy for having these anti-Frankfurt School thoughts about America, that you're crazy to think that Palin isn't the devil, you're crazy to think that Michelle Bachmann, Alan West, Marco Rubio, and Chris Christie aren't the devil, that you're crazy not to think that the U.S. military aren't a net positive, not just for this country, but for the world. You're not crazy. They've created a pop cultural system and an academic system to have you doubt, whether water is wet. And the book is to Corey, I'm a Pied Piper. I'm telling you, come on, join the fight. That which you're most fearful of, rejection, societal rejection, don't be afraid of it, because once you realize that you can stand up to the bully and that you can punch the bully and you can knock the bully down, the bully doesn't know what to do because his entire gig is based upon the realm of fear. That if you stand up to him, that you're never going to live another day. And I'm telling you, it's the exact opposite.
Sounds like you've gone a long way from your initial go along to get along approach in your childhood.
I guess I overreacted to it. I still wake up in an out of body experience thinking that this is my life. And I wake up on Twitter and that there's usually 100 or 200 messages of disgust from the organized left, by the Twitter left, attacking me personally, calling me gay, calling me evil, calling me racist. And it's my daily affirmation. That and coffee gets me up and running. And it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun to, had this trajectory. There are a lot of us, Ron Silver, Dennis Miller. Next month, David Mamet has a book coming out called The Secret Knowledge on the Dismantling of American Culture. He's yet another guy who's standing up to the Democrat media complex. A lot of us are starting to awaken to what happened, and I believe that the Tea Party and new media represent an existential weapon set against the control of the narrative that the left has had for forever. And I think that I think that we could win. I think we could take back the American narrative for people who have long created the perception that they're the majority when in fact they're the minority.
It's interesting, you mentioned Ron Silver, and on your book on page 216, you talk about a burgeoning conservative Hollywood movement, and I wrote that phrase down with three question marks next to it, because Hollywood is so famously and reliably liberal. Well, do you think there's really something going on where there's going to be a transition towards a more conservative Hollywood down the road?
Well, anything, you can't get, it's already more conservative by virtue of this group and these people existing, because nobody knew it. Everybody has been intimidated into their own individual closet. So every conservative that's existed out here has maybe two or three friends or family members that they can confide in that they disagree with the prevailing orthodoxy, because the left at the end of the day is punitive. Its repressive tolerance is inherently intolerant to anyone that would challenge that George Bush is evil or that Sarah Palin is crazy and evil. And so I met these people, Big Hollywood, and the website Big Hollywood became a huge magnet for these people to reach out. My book with Mark Ebner, Hollywood Interrupted, was a big magnet to people because it was a critique on the Hollywood left. And these people have found me, and they found each other. And it's not going to, you know, it's not going to get better in 2 years, 4 years, or 6 years in an election cycle. It's going to get better on a generational thing. And it's going to have to happen with these people starting to realize that they need to find investors in the conservative world, and that we have to engage David Geffen, Steven Spielberg, and Jeffrey Katzenberg in the commerce of ideas. Within pop culture, we have to create content that actually is entertaining and good, because I credit these totalitarians and these, you know, and these people who claim that they don't blacklist. Well, they do. They do put their money where their mouth is. They do use capitalism very well. They open up markets in order to sell their product. Conservatives need to put their money where their mouths are, and actually start to take advantage and make it. If conservatives make films, if conservatives create film companies, then those conservative actors can go out there and say conservative things and still keep getting hired by conservatives who are making the films. Right now, after going out on Fox News and saying, I heart Sarah Palin, they have to go and get a job within the liberal establishment. And trust me, word spreads quick. That you are no longer on the team, as Dennis Miller and David Mamet and Ron Silver would have told you, et cetera. There is no love for those that buck the liberal orthodoxy in this town.
Andrew, you've been very generous with your time. I'd just like to finish up by asking you our signature question here on the podcast, which is, based on what you've learned in writing the book, are there any policies that you would promote or push forward that our listeners could hear about?
Well, you know what? I think my anti-answer may be a profound answer, is that I've always said the cliche that politics is downstream from pop culture. And I am so focused on trying to change things, to radically alter things on a revolutionary front in the mainstream media, in Hollywood, and in academia by exposing the indoctrination process that we talked about, that I'm going to entrust those people that write for me in big government to help to talk about those things. When I go on Fox or CNN and they want me to be talking about policy, they're basically getting me exactly wrong. I'm not even that political a person. I just hate that in the United States of America, that repressive tolerance, political correctness, the controlling of the narrative by the left, the totalitarianism that is inherent in all left-wing totalitarian countries and institutions, whether it be Venezuela, the former Soviet Union, whether it be Cuba, whether it be Turkey, in the name of the free speech movement, creating anti-free speech initiatives, whether it be the fairness doctrine, whether it be calling everybody reflexively a racist, sexist, or homophobic. I want to free up the debate. I want to wrest away control of it from the totalitarians and make it so that there are more voices out there so that policy can be debated between people. Because at the end of the day, I believe that free market ideas win out the day when you live in an environment that is free market when it relates to free speech. And so I am so not a policy person. At the end of the day, I'm ironic. I hate smoking, and I started to see the slippery slope begin towards tyranny and totalitarianism when something that I can't stand, smoking, was, anti-smoking laws were instituted in bars and in restaurants where private citizens, who put all their money towards their investment of having a restaurant. If somebody wants to create Moe's drinking lounge, all smoking drinking lounge, I think he should have the opportunity to do so. But when when the nanny state comes in, the Bloombergs of the world come in and start dictating policy for the greater good at the expense of freedom, that's when I have a problem, even when I benefit from those policies. And so my contradictory point of view is I stop the anti-smoking laws because even though I agree with them in terms of my personal preference, I believe in the free market too great to allow for my independent benefit to outweigh my philosophical benefit, which I think is what this country is founded upon, and that's freedom.
Well, it's certainly a different answer to the question. Usually they're more micro based on a specific policy in the book, but you do raise an interesting point, which is that politics is the means by which people get to implement policy. And for that, I thank you, and I thank you for joining us on the interview today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you, Tavi.
You've been listening to an interview with Andrew Breitbart, the author of Righteous Indignation, Excuse Me While I Save the World. In our talk, we had a fun-filled conversation about Andrew's attempt to bring down what he calls the Democrat media complex, his upbringing in California, his experiences with Arnold Schwarzenegger and 100-mile-an-hour serves aimed at his head, and his general thoughts about how media affects our culture and our politics, and how he is hoping to change it using the new media. I hope you enjoyed it. This is Teddy Troy for New Books in Politics. And look for me in my regular spot as the host of New Books in Public Policy. Thanks very much.